Usually when we talk about a security gate, there's this this expectation of safety, right? You build a sturdy wall, you punch in a specialized code, the heavy lock clicks into place, you're safely on the inside, and all the unpredictability of the outside world is just, it's kept at bay. It's a really comforting boundary for
Well,
you.
totally. I mean, it creates this highly controlled reality, like a comfortable little bubble where everything dangerous or unpleasant is just filtered out of your immediate experience.
Exactly. But step into the first century teachings of Jesus, and suddenly that security gate isn't keeping the danger out at all.
No, not even a little bit.
Right. So we were unpacking a narrative landscape today that is terrifyingly porous. It's the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, and it's found in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16.
A really heavy text.
Yeah, it is. And our goal today on this deep dive isn't just to recount some ancient story. We are going to decode these first century cultural references from a Christian perspective to figure out how someone today is actually supposed to walk the righteous path Jesus laid out.
Which is so important because, well, when you really analyze the mechanics of what Jesus is communicating in this text, it is a profound, demanding blueprint.
Oh, absolutely.
It's about how human beings interact with wealth, how we understand status, and most importantly, how we view the people we would much rather just ignore. It is just as disruptive to a modern, gated community as it was to ancient Judea.
So let's picture the scene, right? Jesus is not just speaking into a void here. He is standing in front of a very specific crowd, and he knows exactly how to push their buttons.
Well, he definitely does. He is addressing the Pharisees. I mean, the Gospel of Luke goes out of its way to explicitly describe this specific group as, and I quote, lovers of money.
Wow, just calls them out directly.
Right. They are actively sneering at what Jesus has been teaching about wealth up to this point.
But why that specific reaction, though? Like, why sneer at someone preaching about the dangers of money?
Well, it's because of how they interpreted the theological mechanics of their day. In first century Judea, wealth was widely viewed as a direct, undeniable sign of God's blessing.
Oh, so it was like, if you have money, God likes you.
Exactly. The prevailing logic was deeply transactional. I mean, if you are rich, it is because you are righteous, and God is actively rewarding you for it. This was rooted in a very rigid, almost prosperity gospel reading of their traditions.
So if you possess a massive estate, you must be like a paragon of virtue, which means, I mean, the flip side of that equation has to be incredibly dark.
Oh, the flip side was brutal. Poverty, chronic sickness, physical disability. These were seen as hard evidence of a hidden sin or a divine curse.
Boy, really a curse.
If you were starving or diseased, the cultural assumption was that you or maybe your parents had done something heinous to deserve it. You were viewed as, well, spiritually defective.
Man, that sets up a wildly hostile environment for what Jesus is about to say.
It really does.
So, he launches into this fictional story using imagery this crowd would instantly recognize. First up is the rich man. Jesus describes him as wearing purple and fine linen and feasting sumptuously every single day.
Which is a huge detail.
Right. So let's dig into the reality of that. What does that level of wealth actually look like in the ancient Roman world?
We really have to move far past our modern idea of just, buying a nice designer suit.
Okay, so more than Gucci.
Way more. In antiquity, purple dye, specifically Tyrian purple, was extracted drop by drop from the decaying glands of thousands of sea snails.
Oof, wait, sea snails, that sounds disgusting.
It was. The manufacturing process was incredibly labor-intensive and foul-smelling, like it smelled awful, but that made the dye astonishingly expensive. I mean, it was quite literally worth its weight in silver or gold.
That's insane.
And in fact, wearing purple was sometimes legally restricted to royalty or high-ranking Roman officials.
So it wasn't just a fashion statement, it was a loud, in-your-face declaration of supreme power.
Exactly. It signaled astronomical status. And the fine linen mentioned alongside it, that was likely imported from Egypt, worn as this luxurious undergarment. It is the ancient equivalent of parading your unfathomable net worth directly on your body.
Let's put this into perspective for you listening. If you were living back then, encountering this man would be like watching someone step out of a custom, multi-million-dollar private jet in one-of-a-kind haute couture every single day.
Every single day.
And the rest of the Roman Empire at this time, like, what was their daily life like?
Well, the vast majority of laborers and peasants were just subsisting on meager daily rations of bread and grain. They were constantly teetering on the edge of starvation.
So the contrast is just massive.
Right. The economic disparity wasn't just a wide gap, it was a completely different universe. This rich man is living in a state of perpetual, extravagant, unimaginable luxury.
Okay, so then Jesus introduces the second character to the crowd. And this detail always catches me off guard. Jesus actually gives this guy a name. Out of all his parables, this is the only time that happens, right?
That is absolutely correct. Every other parable features, you know, a certain man or a farmer or a merchant. But here, Jesus names him Lazarus.
Which means what exactly?
Well, the name Lazarus translates to God has helped, which carries a massive, heavy dose of irony considering his condition at the start of the story.
Because his physical state is horrific. I mean, he's covered in sores, lying right at the rich man's gate, hoping for just the scraps that fall from the table.
Just the scraps.
Yeah, and then the story throws in this incredibly visceral detail about dogs coming and licking his sores.
Right, and the imagery is intentionally brutal, and it serves two purposes. First, the presence of the dogs highlights Lazarus's absolute physical vulnerability. He is so weak, so broken, that he cannot even swat away street scavengers.
And these aren't like cute golden retrievers.
Yeah.
No, not at all. These are feral street dogs. But more crucially, we have to look at the religious mechanics of the time.
What do you mean by religious mechanics?
Well, under ancient Jewish purity laws, dogs were largely viewed as unclean animals. So being licked by them wasn't just gross or painful. It meant Lazarus was perpetually, ritually impure. He is completely contaminated.
Oh, wow. So he couldn't even participate in the religious life of his own community.
Not at all. He is cut off from the temple, cut off from community worship, cut off from society entirely. Lazarus is the ultimate outcast. He is physically shattered, perpetually starving, and religiously disqualified.
Which creates massive narrative whiplash for the original audience listening to Jesus.
Oh, they would have been so thrown.
Right, because they would look at the rich man in his Tyrian purple and immediately think, ah, a blessed righteous man. They look at Lazarus with the dogs and think, ah, a cursed, wicked man. Jesus sets the board up exactly the way the Pharisees expect the world to work.
He leans entirely into their biases.
But then the inevitable happens, right? Both men die. And you'd think the earthly hierarchy would just carry over into the afterlife based on the crowd's theology. But Jesus completely flips the board.
He turns it upside down.
He really does. The rich man ends up in torment in Hades, while Lazarus is carried by angels to Abraham's side, which honestly raises a massive question. The text makes it clear that the rich man wasn't damned simply for having a large bank account. So what actually doomed him?
This is the crux of the moral framework Jesus is building for the righteous path. If you look closely at the narrative, the rich man is never condemned for act of malice.
Right, he's not a supervillain.
No, he isn't an extortionist. He didn't order his servants to go beat Lazarus. He didn't steal the man's land or cheat him in a business deal.
Hold on, I have to push back here. You're telling me he goes to eternal torment, basically, for minding his own business, just for living his life and accepting the status quo.
That is precisely what makes this teaching so terrifying and so radical. His sin is one of omission. He is condemned for what he failed to do. It's the sin of profound, sustained indifference.
Apathy.
Pure apathy. He accepted the gaping canyon between his opulent luxury and Lazarus' starvation as a completely normal, acceptable state of affairs. Keep in mind, Lazarus was placed at his gate.
Literally at his front door.
Right. The rich man had to walk past him or step over him or hear him every single day.
So he saw him. He knew he was there. He just didn't care.
He didn't view Lazarus as a fellow human being made in the image of God. He viewed him as part of the landscape, a tragic but ultimately irrelevant piece of scenery at his security gate.
Man, that implies the righteous path isn't just about avoiding bad deeds. It's about the sheer spiritual danger of ignoring the opportunity for good ones.
Exactly.
So let's talk about where they actually end up, because the story uses some very specific concepts for the afterlife, Abraham's side and Hades. How would a first century listener have pictured this?
Well, Jesus is leaning into Second Temple Jewish folklore here to make his point. By this period in history, popular thought had developed a very vivid geography of the afterlife.
Okay, like what?
So Abraham's bosom, or Abraham's side, was envisioned as the place of ultimate comfort and honor for the righteous dead. Imagine being seated right next to the patriarch of the entire faith at a magnificent eternal banquet.
Basically, the ultimate VIP section?
Precisely. On the other hand, Hades was understood as the realm of the dead, but specifically the compartment associated with separation, regret, and fiery torment for the wicked.
So Jesus takes the theological assumptions of the Pharisees and just shatters them to pieces.
He completely destroys them. The beggar they assumed was cursed by God is elevated to the highest possible honor. The rich man they assumed was blessed is isolated in agony.
Earthly status, Jesus is saying, has absolutely zero bearing on eternal reality.
None whatsoever.
And here is the part of the story that absolutely blows my mind. The rich man is in torment. He looks up. He sees Abraham far off, with Lazarus right there beside him. And his heart hasn't changed one bit.
It's crazy. It reveals the horrifying depth of his spiritual blindness. You would expect him to be weeping, apologizing, begging Lazarus for forgiveness for ignoring him all those years.
Right, like, I'm so sorry, I should have helped you, but what does he do?
He speaks only to Abraham, the fellow man of status, and he literally tries to use Lazarus as an errand boy.
Yes.
He says, Father Abraham, send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue.
He's in Hades. And he still thinks he's the boss.
It's wild. He still views Lazarus as a tool for his own comfort.
That is just, I mean, death changed his zip code, but it did absolutely nothing to alter his character.
Nothing at all. He still cannot see Lazarus as an equal. You know, the story mentions a great chasm fixed between them in the afterlife, but that physical chasm is really just a permanent reflection of the spiritual chasm the rich man built in his own heart while he was alive.
Hmm. Oh, that's a great way to put it. So the rich man realizes he's stuck. Nobody is crossing that chasm to bring him water. And since he can't get relief for himself, he suddenly remembers he has five brothers still living.
Right, the family he left behind.
So he pivots and demands a spectacular miracle. He begs Abraham to send Lazarus back from the dead as a ghost to warn them so they don't end up in the same torment.
Which forces us to look at the mechanics of how human beings actually arrive at truth and how they change their behavior. I mean, why won't Abraham send Lazarus back to scare these brothers straight? It seems like a reasonable request to prevent eternal suffering.
Right. But Abraham shuts it down immediately. He says, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Moses and the Prophets is first century shorthand for the Hebrew Scriptures, what Christians now call the Old Testament. Abraham is stating that the texts they already have in their possession are fundamentally sufficient.
Sufficient for what?
The existing scriptures comprehensively detailed how to live justly.
Let's drill into that. What exactly in those ancient texts were the brothers ignoring? Because it wasn't just vague advice to, you know, be nice.
Oh, far from it. The entire economic and social ethic of the Hebrew Bible was designed to protect the vulnerable. The Law of Moses included explicit instructions like gleaning laws.
What are gleaning laws?
So it mandated that you couldn't harvest your fields to the very edges. You had to leave crops behind specifically for the poor and the foreigner to gather.
Oh, wow. So charity was built into the agricultural system.
Exactly. And there was the Year of Jubilee, which was a radical economic reset designed to prevent perpetual systemic poverty by returning land to its original owners and freeing debt slaves.
That's huge.
And the prophets, like Isaiah and Amos, they constantly thundered against the wealthy elites who trampled on the poor to build their winter houses.
So the blueprint was already there. It was highly detailed. They didn't need new information.
They didn't lack information. They lacked obedience. And that leads to Abraham's final devastating line in the parable. If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead.
Scripture over spectacle.
Always. The theological mechanic here is crucial for understanding the Christian perspective. Miracles do not cure a hardened heart.
That's a hard truth.
It is. If a person is actively choosing to ignore the written word out of selfishness, apathy, or greed, a supernatural spectacle isn't going to suddenly transform them into a compassionate neighbor. They will find a way to rationalize, dismiss, or ignore the miraculous, too.
It's incredible to think about because Jesus is telling this entirely fictional parable, but the narrative is actually acting as a massive piece of real-world foreshadowing.
It predicts the exact reaction of the very crowd he is speaking to.
Right. Because Jesus himself is going to be executed, and he will literally rise from the dead just a short time later.
Yeah.
And the religious authorities, the ones who already rejected the calls for justice in Moses and the prophets, they're going to reject Jesus' resurrection too.
Yeah.
It proves the parable's premise in real time. A hardened heart will deny a literal resurrection if accepting it means surrendering their selfishness and their status.
It is a profound psychological and spiritual truth about human nature.
So we see the historical shock value. We understand the mechanics of the Great Reversal and why a supernatural spectacle won't fix human apathy. But, you know, the mission of this deep dive is to figure out how this ancient text actively applies to walking the righteous path today.
Right, bringing it to the present.
Because the afterlife chasm in the story is fixed, but the earthly chasm we are dealing with right now, that one can still be crossed.
For anyone trying to live out this Christian ethic today, this parable is incredibly urgent. It demands active daily application. And the very first step is learning to identify the Lazarus at your gate.
Which requires a bit of modern translation. Because most of us don't live on walled estates with heavy wooden gates and guards, where impoverished people are physically sitting on our property line covered in sores.
Right. In the ancient world, gates were literal physical barriers keeping the destitute outside. Today, keeping to the righteous path requires understanding that our gates are largely invisible. They are structural. They are systemic.
How does that actually play out in a modern city? Like, give me an example.
Well, think about the socioeconomic divides built right into urban planning. We have zoning laws that deliberately keep affordable housing out of affluent neighborhoods.
Oh, sure.
We have school district lines drawn to consolidate wealth and resources. We have built massive, complex societal structures to keep the suffering out of our immediate daily sight. To find Lazarus today, you have to actively seek him out because the system is perfectly designed to hide him from you.
That idea of invisible gates is fascinating, and it makes me think about the most powerful invisible gate we interact with every single day. The algorithms that curate our social media feeds, our news apps, our entertainment. The very mechanism of an algorithm is to show you what keeps you engaged and comfortable.
Right. It optimizes entirely for your comfort and your preferences.
Yeah. It curates a reality of beautiful vacations, perfect meals, success stories, and aesthetic trends. It is the modern purple and fine linen.
Wow. That's so true.
And in doing so, it filters out the pain. It acts as a highly efficient, personalized gatekeeper, keeping the suffering of the world out of sight so we can just keep feasting sumptuously, scrolling endlessly, without feeling the guilt of our own inaction. We have built digital gates to protect our apathy.
That is the exact mechanism of the rich man's sin, just modernized. If you don't intentionally break through that curated digital bubble, you naturally default to the rich man's posture.
Right. You accept the canyon between your comfort and someone else's starvation as a normal state of affairs.
Exactly. So the mandate here is to bridge the chasm now while you still have breath. Followers of this path are called to leverage their time, their influence, and their resources to build bridges of compassion.
Because the parable isn't saying that wealth itself is a guaranteed ticket to Hades.
No. Wealth is morally neutral. But it is meant to be stewarded for the kingdom of God, not hoarded to insulate yourself from the pain of others.
Right.
The rich man's catastrophic failure was hoarding his resources while ignoring the suffering at his doorstep. If he had opened his gate, stepped outside, and used his resources to heal and feed Lazarus, the entire trajectory of eternity shifts. The chasm can be crossed today. You just have to choose to open the gate.
And that brings us back to the final takeaway about scripture versus spectacle. It feels like modern culture is absolutely obsessed with finding the next big sign.
Oh, we crave dramatic spiritual experiences. People constantly want a definitive, undeniable sign from God to tell them exactly what to do with their lives. Or they want a spectacular emotional high during worship to prove that their faith is real.
But the parable essentially says, read the room. Or rather, read the book.
Exactly. The will of God for how to treat other human beings is already explicitly outlined. You don't need a ghost to return from the void to give you a customized mission statement.
Right.
Act justly. Love mercy. Walk humbly. True righteousness is proven by quiet, daily obedience to the word we already possess, not by constantly chasing miracles. You don't need a spectacle to be righteous. You just need to look at the vulnerable person standing right in front of you.
The path of the righteous isn't about waiting for some miraculous burning bush sign to finally start doing good. It's about seeing the people right at our gates. It's about crossing the chasm of indifference while we still have the time and stewarding whatever influence, money, or resources we have with completely open hands.
It really is.
The terrifying truth of this teaching is that the security gates we build to keep ourselves comfortable might actually be the very things trapping us in spiritual blindness.
And the people society trains us to view as marginalized, burdensome, or cursed might actually be the ones closest to the heart of God.
I want to leave you with one final thought to ponder on your own, building on that idea of the digital algorithm as our modern gate. If this ancient story tells us that miracles cannot change hardened heart, and our screens are constantly curating a reality that keeps the suffering of the world out of our sight? Is our culture's constant scrolling for the next viral piece of inspiration actually a spiritual trap?
Mm.
Are we looking so hard for a modern miracle, for a spectacle to make us feel something profound, that we are completely ignoring the Lazarus sitting quietly on the other side of our screens? Something to think about. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.